anything with value neutral attached to it. And then the three panelists will present their view of the play, and then we'll have some time at the end for what we're going to do with the audience, comments, questions, reactions, testimonies that you have seen the play and what you thought. I'm Bob Larson. I worked for a number of years in a probation department and then worked in a social service department, and almost all of my career was taken up in working with children until the very end, when I graduated and worked with elderly people and found it was the other end of the same spectrum, except with elderly people, we're a little more exasperated when they act like children than we are when children act like children. At any rate, I retired from that. I received a degree ever so long ago from BYU in psychology, and from Cal in clinical psychology. And when my career was tending towards administration, I got a degree in public administration from Hayward. Sharon Larson, my old friend of 40 years, I've known her longer than anyone, wanted me to say that she also has an education. It doesn't show up on the program. It says she owns a bookstore. It's a children's bookstore. And during the time when the bookstore was open and I was still working with children, I'd be dealing in the daytime with abused and battered children, and she'd be dealing with the idyllic world of children, of children's books. And there was kind of a cognitive dissonance there that was interesting. Two very different perceptions of the world exist. At any rate, several years ago, after being 13 or 14 or some number of years a sophomore, and our younger children were off to kindergarten, she went back to school and became one of the very first reentry persons. Although in those days, you didn't call it that. We didn't think anything of it. It was no big deal. Later on, we discovered it was quite a social feat to have accomplished that. And we have been very proud of Sharon and our family for going through college at that phase in her life, receiving a degree in English and eventually a secondary education degree. And she ended her career teaching as a teacher of reading, special reading situations. Trevor Southey is an artist. He was born in Rhodesia, went on a mission to South Africa, has taught at BYU for 8 years, and is an artist of considerable talent. He had the most famous picture of his, or mural, I guess it was in the Salt Lake Airport, created a great controversy in Utah, and I am told now it's in a private collection and no longer at the airport. In fact, last time I was through the Salt Lake Airport, there was nothing like what you describe in your painting. There was a big thing about Canyonlands sitting there, and so I guess that's the substitution in Salt Lake for your painting. In any event, let me give you the background of the play as briefly as I can. Now, please understand that the play is 7 hours long, and you cannot boil 7 hours down very conveniently into 5 minutes, but I will do that. Tony Kushner received the 1993 Pulitzer Prize in Drama for Millennium Approaches, part one of a 7-hour play, Angels in America, subtitled A Gay Fantasia on National Themes. The play is currently in production by the American Conservatory Theater in San Francisco at the Marines Memorial Theater. Locally, it has been very well received. The San Francisco Chronicle critic Steve Wynn comments, "Kushner created a work that addressed the complexities of history, politics, public morality and private lives that define the collective American experience. Angels made the theater seem, instead of a graying diversion dwarfed by the electronic arts, a vital, essential form of ideas and conscience. Kushner describes America as a melting pot where nothing melted. One of the things that did not melt is Kushner's use of Mormon characters, history, and mythos to provide an antagonistic base against which to contrast the gay fantasia. The play is placed in the Reagan era and probes the social, political, moral, and spiritual malaise of that era. Currently, that malaise is still with us and has deepened into a more violent, factionated, and politically correct society. One wonders seriously if the American Center can hold. Kushner contributes to that by Mormon bashing, or perhaps he depicts Mormons as merely human beings. In either event, he writes of Mormons not in the light that Mormons like to see themselves. For the many in the audience who are not familiar with the play, I will attempt a brief synopsis. There is a longer and more coherent synopsis in Dialogue, the winter 1994 issue by David Pace. Part of the problem in presenting a synopsis is that a lot happens in 7 hours. The other part of the problem is Kushner's playwriting style. He often uses split scenes in which the dialogue between one set of actors amplifies and enlightens that which is taking place with a second set of actors. Kushner also uses actors in multiple roles. I thought this was to save money, but I think now it has symbolic meaning. Characters in the play often appear as visions in other characters' scenes. The mannequins at the Mormons' Visitor Center transfigure into characters in the play. Kushner deliberately blurs the boundary of between reality and fantasy, which vastly complicates the telling of the story, but it is also vastly entertaining. With all this as caveat, I will simplify the play by following the storylines of the major sets of characters. Joe and Harper Pitt, a Mormon attorney and his wife living in New York. Roy Cohn, of House Un-American Activities fame, Prior Walter, AIDS victim and prophet, and his lover Lewis Ironson. Joe Pitt's mother, Hannah, and Prior Walter's former lover, the drag queen Belize, and of course, the angel. So those are the main characters. There are some other characters, but we'll just follow these. To follow these in order, Joe and Harper Pitt, the Mormons, have a troubled marriage caused by Joe's lack of sexual interest in Harper. Joe has homosexual feelings, perhaps not even acknowledged by himself. Harper has taken to Valium as a mode of escape from this unpleasant situation. Joe is offered a better job by Roy Cohn, for reasons I still haven't figured out, but that's how it goes. He does not accept the job because of Harper's refusal to move to Washington. Joe encounters Lewis, and they engage in an affair which ends disastrously for both Joe and Harper. In the meantime, Joe calls his mother in Salt Lake City to declare that he is a homosexual. By play's end, Harper leaves Joe, Lewis rejects Joe, and Roy Cohn dies. Joe has nothing to show for his trouble, as it were. Prior Walter develops the final stages of AIDS. Lewis's lover abandons him, and a lot of the play is about this sense of abandonment, and spends the rest of the play whining and trying to expiate himself from the guilt of abandonment of his very sick friend. Prior Walter is hospitalized. Prior's nurse is his former lover, Belize. This is getting a little complicated. Whose role in the play is that of a cynical realist. Prior receives a nighttime visit from two other previous Prior Walters who have died in prior plagues. So this is the symbolism. Prior Walter is dying of a plague. Other Prior Walters in the past have died of plagues, and so it's a story of the plagues over and over again. But these Prior Walters are heralds to the angel. After many omens and portents, the angel appears in high theatrical style, it was wonderful theater, to declare Prior Walter to be a prophet. Prior's reaction is, why me? He is given a large, bright steel book and the sacred prophetic instruments. Pryor tries going about in prophetic garb. He doesn't know how to be a prophet, so he puts on a robe, which he thinks looks prophetic, and he goes around in this robe. But he can get no handle on actually being a prophet, and eventually returns the book to heaven. Unlike the Mormon account, the angel seems not to be giving direction to Pryor Walter, but is seeking direction from Pryor. It's an interesting point. The problem is that God disappeared from heaven the day of the San Francisco earthquake, leaving the heavenly hosts to fend for themselves. In some vague way, a prophet is seen as helping the situation. Also, unlike the Mormon account, the angel is very sexy. Roy Cohn is the personification of power and evil. Where Lewis displeases by constant self-recrimination, Roy displeases through manipulative power. He has no recriminations at all. He is proud that he was responsible for the death penalty for Ethel Rosenberg. For vague reasons, Roy likes Joe and tries to bring Joe into his sphere of influence. Roy is a homosexual, and like Pryor, he is dying of AIDS, but Roy calls it liver cancer. And this is historical fact, that particular point. Roy dies, and one of the final scenes, he is in hell, or purgatory, bargaining with God about defending against the lawsuit the angels have filed, accusing God of abandoning his children. Now, that scene is only in the text. It wasn't played in the San Francisco version of the play, so you'll miss that if you go see it. Finally, there is Hannah, the world's only unfriendly Mormon. When Hannah learns of Joe's homosexuality, she sells her house in Salt Lake and moves to Manhattan. Although grim, she is adaptable. And like Belize, she is a realist, but without his cynicism. She is the one who perseveres to the end. She begins working at the Mormon Visitor Center. She encounters Pryor Walter in Belize, and by the play's end, she is their confidant and has become an adopted New Yorker. Pryor Walter has lived for 5 years with AIDS, having received a blessing from heaven. Kushner uses a translation of the Hebrew blessing as meaning more life. And so Pryor is given more life. The play just sort of finishes. An epilogue ties up the loose ends, but it's not a climatic ending. There is no sense of resolution. Things go on as screwed up as they ever were. The ending was depressing to me. Nobody came to realize, as in Mormon popular fiction. I think depression is the accurate emotion intended by Kushner for the audience to view the state of the world now or in the future. Okay, so that's the summary of the play. Now I will change a hat and give you my personal remarks about the play. I was intrigued to discover while on a trip to Europe as a young adult that Americans were not the only ugly people. You may remember, those of you who are as old as I can remember the ugly Americans. Depending on the country, there were ugly Italians, ugly Frenchmen, ugly Britons, and so on. The critical difference was that Americans cared about being seen as ugly Americans. It did not suit our image of ourselves. The other people seemed to have only disdain for their critics. I found myself reacting as an ugly Mormon to Tony Kushner's depiction of Mormondom in Angels in America. He criticized Mormon beliefs with a deft use of theatrical skills. He attacked the Mormon image with satire, and in the doing, he made several telling blows. However, if Kushner were all negative, we should end this review right here. He is not all negative, which compels the playgoer to listen to what he has to say. There are two main ways in which Kushner expresses his viewpoint. First, in Millennium Approaches, his characters appear much more stereotyped than in Perestroika. Perestroika is the second half of the play. And I was wondering about that, and I assume that Kushner became more mature and adept as a playwright. It took 5 years to write the play. And during that time, he came to have some increased understanding of Mormons. And this to me, is an important point. We'll sort of play with this as we go along. Second, he differentiates Mormons as an institutional church from Mormons as individual human beings. As human beings, they come off better. Now, I'm not really happy with how I wrote that. I wrote that about 10 times and did it in my head 10 more, and it still hasn't come out exactly how I want to say what I feel about what Kushner is doing here. But he is differentiating Mormons, like individual people, from Mormons presented as an image. And I wanted to call it a stereotype, and I originally called it a stereotype, but a stereotype doesn't fit what I'm trying to say here. It wasn't a stereotype. In Millennium Approaches, I connected very little to the characters that represented Mormons as Mormons. Thinking of reviews I had heard and read, I thought, were being a little bit upset and hysterical. Kushner is not getting a leg up on the Mormon literary world. Joe and Harper and Hannah are Mormons in name only. Kushner says they are Mormons, but that doesn't matter much. They could just as easily be Baptists. And if you took the first part of the play, Millennium Approaches, and just substitute Baptist for Mormon, leave out the angel, nobody could tell they weren't Baptists. There's nothing in there that says that these are Mormon people. Then I wondered if Baptists would care about what Kushner wrote. Of course they would care some, but I suspect they would not care in the same way that we care. It's a heavy responsibility belonging to the true church, and those in the church must be more perfect than other people. This perfectness is one of the major Mormon traits that Kushner attacks. "Find a law you can break," Roy Cohn says to Joe. "There are so many of them." He's telling Joe, you know, just become more human. Break a law or two. And you got a lot of laws to break. Kushner finds the self-proclaimed true church antithetical to a church that's openly homophobic. Given this view of the Mormon church, Kushner's attacks from every quarter. And I think, well, he ought to. Plus, Mormonism is richly endowed with theatrical characters and dramatic scenes, including angelic visitations, a mother lode of material for a playwright. Kushner said he learned about Mormonism from his study of Fawn Brody and Harold Bloom. This is a curious statement, since Bloom did not publish The American Religion until 1992, a little before Perestroika was completed. However, whatever dramatic elements he borrowed from these two, it did not come over into a representation of people who had any flavor of being Mormons. Harper, Joe, and Hannah are not even Fawn Brody Mormons. Maybe Harper is in her Valium-induced hallucinations. But there's no home teaching, no family home evening, no temple recommend interview, no state conferences, no meetings of any kind, a serious admission, no missionaries over for dinner, no trappings of Mormonism except garments and the visitor center. Now, just by contrast, see Scott Card's Lost Boys for an example of how Mormonism can be woven into a cast of fictional characters. All of this was lost on the people sitting next to me in the theater. They seemed to take some delight in Mormons being depicted as buffoons. It seemed to confirm their stereotypes about Mormons. Kushner, in fact, confesses that he has played footloose and fancy-free with Mormons as stereotypes. In Perestroika, Prior Walter chides Hannah Pitt about what she believes about her church. "Hannah, our prophet, his desire made prayer. His prayer made an angel. The angel was real. I believe that. Prior, I don't. And I'm sorry, but that's repellent to me, so much of what you believe. Hannah, what do I believe? Prior, I'm a homosexual with AIDS. And I can just imagine what you, Hannah, no, you can't imagine the things in my head. You don't make assumptions about me, mister, and I won't make them about you. Prior, fair enough. A little later, prior. I wish you would be true to your demographic profile. Life is confusing enough. I can imagine these lines being said by a real Mormon, not a stereotype Mormon. Incidentally, Perestroika reads better than it plays, and Millennium Approaches plays better than it reads. Or why that is, I don't know, but that's a fact. If the Mormon characters did not resonate much for me, and this is not to say that there are no Mormons out there like Joe Harper and Hannah, the angel resonated not at all. Another critic described the angel as marvelously silly. To me, this is an apt description. This is not Kushner's view of the angel at all. In Kushner's words, the angel is immensely august, serious, and dangerously powerful. Quoting from Mormon literature, Isaiah via 1 Nephi, the angel will bring a marvelous work and a wonder. Indeed, the angel brings a metal book and prophetic instruments, but there the comparison with Moroni ends. Kushner's angel has 8 vaginas, several phalli, and induces orgasms in both male and female, characteristics not found in the Moroni we know. Kushner's angel is part of a heavenly bureaucracy that takes on the flavor of a parade of nations pageant. Intentionally or not, Kushner is more closely akin to Mormon heavenly concepts. Kingdoms in heaven for righteous members, kingdoms built on good deeds done on earth accruing from a heavenly bank account, and heavenly missionary work for one and all. Heaven is a city much like San Francisco, says Kushner, an analogy not likely to receive great acceptance in Salt Lake City. Kushner's major thesis is that God has deserted his children. If this were not so, how are suffering and injustice and plagues to be explained? This, he says, is the incontrovertible argument against the existence of a just God, or at least his competence and attentiveness. And in keeping with this, Kushner's angel must be silly. He couldn't have a serious angel. Later in the play, Hannah and Harper are at the Mormon Visitor Center. Here, Kushner's satire is wickedly accurate. At the Visitor Center, Harper notes, this isn't a place for real feelings. This is just storytelling here. The diorama scene transitions to one where Lewis makes fun of Joe's fruity underwear. This I found offensive and superfluous to the play. Kushner seems to dislike all aspects of the Mormon experience. He derides the story of the Restoration. He pokes fun at the Pioneer Saga. Especially, he detrusts the happy, contented Mormon. It is as if he cannot believe that there is genuine happiness anywhere, and such expressions are either manipulative, as a proselyting technique, or self-delusional, as with Hannah or Harper. But he treats Jewish history and ritual with respect. He opens the play with a tribute to the Jewish migration to America from Eastern Europe, which can be seen as analogous to the Mormon Pioneer Saga. And one of the most touching scenes in the play is when Ethel Rosenberg and Lewis say the Kaddish, I'm not sure of the pronunciation, the Jewish prayer for the dead in Yiddish for Roy Cohn. My initial reaction to this while watching the play was that this was an unabashed Mormon bashing. If your people can have respect for their story and ritual, why can't there be respect for mine? I'm saying this to myself. So if Kushner can respect Jewish ritual and Jewish tradition, why can't he allow me to respect Mormon tradition and ritual? Kushner says 2 very profound things on this point. On tolerance, how much is tolerance worth? Nothing. And underneath all tolerance is intense, passionate hatred. And about Roy Cohn, easily the most hated person in the play, Belice admonishes Lewis. Forgiveness isn't easy. It doesn't count if it's easy. It's the hardest thing, forgiveness, which is maybe where love and justice finally meet. In 7 hours of play, one expects a message, and this is the message: to find forgiveness and to bless. but it appears in the penultimate position in the play. The rest of the play is a winding down, leaving the characters somewhat more relaxed, perhaps, but without hope except in the few moments of relief they can find in an unforgiving world. Kushner's message is not for Mormons. Few will get past the Mormon bashing, the profanity, the overt sexuality, the satire, and the pessimism to see that this is a serious play about serious issues. The report from the only other average Mormon I know of to have seen the play was it was about a Mormon family. Others in the play found that they had useful principles to live by. This was not the play I saw. Kushner does not write a prescription for what the world should be or how the world might change. He writes to describe the world as he finds it, and I think that's task enough for most people.
It's difficult to get over feeling like a persecuted minority. My family moved to Utah when I was a child, and my parents sat me down and gave me two lectures. I got to remember that this is 100 years after Nauvoo and more than 50 years after the Manifesto. The first lecture was my responsibility to be an example of the church. I didn't pay much attention. The second was how I was to act in case somebody teased or ridiculed me or other ways made fun of me for being a Mormon. I listened to that one. That one really caused me to worry. And no one did. No one even cared. And I grew up being just fine. But still, I bought our tickets to go see Angels in America for much the same reason that I turned on the tube to watch Avenging Angels a few weeks ago. I wanted to see what they had to say about us. I can't quite get past being persecuted by everyone else. Now, somewhere inside me, there's this rational person who knows that Tony Kushner was not writing a Mormon play. That he had, in fact, if you read anything that he says about writing the play, he doesn't mention Mormonism unless somebody asks him about it. And then he says that he chose Mormonism because the church hierarchy is actively homophobic. No question, you know, who can deny? And yet, I keep wondering, you know, did it have to be us? We're not the only homophobic church out there. In fact, I have this fantasy about a Southern Baptist who's just furious that he chose this cult instead of a real church. But others have suggested that either on his part, consciously or unconsciously, we've been chosen because we're an American church, and that fits in with his title. And then, of course, we have that angel, which causes me to wonder if he had just written it today when angels are the hottest things in pop fiction and everybody has angels, maybe we'd have been spared. Maybe this wouldn't have had to be about us at all. So before we went to see Millennium Approaches, I put on all my psychological armor, went with all my shields in place. We took some hits, but so did everybody. Blacks, Jews, attorneys, the medical profession, even the homeless got bashed in part one. I came away thinking, this wasn't so bad, I can take this. And so I went to Perestroika pretty confident and considerably less well-armed and came away shattered and offended. We get bashed in part two. In retrospect, it's Joe, or through Joe, however, that we get bashed, and he probably deserves it. The two Mormon women come off pretty well in Angels, and it's about Mormon women that I want to talk. And in fact, we come off in many ways more human and more real than we sometimes do in the ensign. In fact, if there is a single group that does not get bashed by Kushner, that group is women. Ethel Rosenberg is wonderful. Emily the nurse is wonderful. And you sort of, you know, a lot of the men really get it, but the women come off really well. And it may have to do with his having made peace with his mother before her death, because you can see his mother in a lot of Harper, from things he said about his, not Harper, Hannah, about his own mother, or because of his friendship with Kim Flynn. But I can't say why we come off well, but women come off well in Angels. Bob made a pretty good case for the Mormon characters not seeming like real Mormons, but he does manage to portray two well-established types of Mormon women, the unhappy, depressed wife and the supermother. I've spent more than a little time muddling about these types, examining my attitudes, and wondering if I should applaud or condemn the portrayals. One of our daughters, who has pretty much severed all connection with the church, claims that Mormonism has no claim on these types, that they are typical of all American women. But in our day and age, typing of any kind has taken on negative connotations. In America, we all want to be unique. But the constraints of theater, if 7 hours can be considered constrained, require typing and assigning roles, and Kushner seems to have found appropriate roles for Hannah and Harper. Type and cast came into our language as printing terms long before they were terms in literature or in theater. And they bring two other terms that also derive from printing, archetype and stereotype. In printing, an archetype is the original mold, the casting from which all the rest are made. A stereotype is two-dimensional, and other impressions can be made from that. Now, these are absolutely neutral definitions. As soon as you get into a literature class, an archetype is good and a stereotype is bad. And then Jungian psychologists have taken them yet another way. Archetypes are powerful inner forces, patterns of instinctual behavior contained in a collective unconscious. Stereotypes are controlled by outer forces. They are the roles that society expects us to conform to. And what I really wonder is, if Kushner has recreated Mormon women, has he recreated stereotypes or archetypes? It was the 1979 KSL documentary, Mormon Women and Depression, the transcript was reprinted in Sunstone, that brought the problem into the open. At first, the official church attitude seemed to focus on one major conclusion, that Mormon women are not depressed in higher numbers than are women in the general population. I'm not sure that that's a real powerful conclusion. However, since then, there seem to have been Ensign articles on depression. I know that I personally gave a Relief Society lesson given with the subject. And I talked to a friend of mine who works for church social services now, asking if women and depression are still an issue. And she said yes, that they are planning a seminar this month for women, and that women and depression is one of the major topics. Another major conclusion of this documentary, and one that's been more or less ignored by the church in general, was that Mormon women who become depressed feel guilty about being depressed. Harper reflects this. She says at one point in the play, "If I was a good Mormon, I could have pulled it off." And to Pryor, she describes herself as a Jack Mormon. It means I'm flawed, inferior Mormon product. Joe describes it this way. "The fail to measure up hits people very hard. From such a strong desire to feel good, they feel very far from goodness when they fall." And another one of our skeletons comes out of the closet when Joe talks about Harper. He says, "She had a really bad time at home when she was a kid. Her home was really bad. I think a lot of drinking and physical stuff. She doesn't talk about that. Instead, she talks about the sky falling down, people with knives hiding under sofas, monsters, Mormons. Everyone thinks Mormons don't come from homes like that. We aren't supposed to behave that way, but we do." To avoid worrying about her failing marriage, Harper worries about the ozone layer. In her opening speech, she describes it, "When you look at the ozone layer from outside, from a spaceship, it looks like a pale blue halo, a gentle, shimmering aureole encircling the atmosphere, encircling the Earth. 30 miles above our heads, a thin layer of 3-atom oxygen molecules, product of photosynthesis, which explains the fussy vegetable preference for visible light, its rejection of darker rays and emanations, danger from without. It's a kind of gift, a gift from God, the crowning touch to the creation of the world, guardian angels, hands linked to make a spherical net, a blue-green nesting orb, a shell of safety for life itself." If it's true that a writer's attitude towards his characters is reflected in the lines he assigns to them, it becomes very clear that Kushner is fond of Harper, depression and all. He gives her some of the most lyrical, beautiful lines in the whole play. Her final speech, which she makes in an airplane en route to San Francisco, mirrors her opening speech. When we hit 35,000 feet, we'll have reached the tropopause, the great belt of calm air, as close as I'll ever get to the ozone. I dreamed we were there. The plane leapt the tropopause, the safe air, and attained the outer rim, the ozone, which was ragged and torn, patches of it threadbare as old cheesecloth, and that was frightening. But I saw something only I could see because of my astonishing ability to see such things. Souls were rising from the earth far below, souls of the dead, of people who had perished from famine, from war, from the plague, and they floated up like skydivers in reverse, limbs all akimbo, wheeling and spinning, and the souls of these departed joined hands, clasped ankles, and formed a web, a great net of souls, and the souls were three atom molecules of the stuff of ozone, and the outer rib absorbed them and was repaired. Unlike most people I've talked to or read about Harper's future, I'm not very optimistic. Part of the problem is that I could not tell whether her insights were coming from within herself or from external sources, because she gets most of her insights when she's in the middle of a delusion. The surrealistic nature of the play gets in the way of my understanding this character. In the play, she and Pryor appear in each other's mutual delusions, and that later when they do meet, this confuses her because she said, how could she have a delusion about somebody she's never met before? But she does, and they have what they refer to as threshold of revelation. They are able to tell each other things about each other. And in this scene, he tells her that her husband is a homosexual. Now, is this actually a revelation that she is getting from within herself because this other person doesn't really exist except in the delusion? Or is this something that an external force is telling her? In another scene, when she and the Mormon mother from the diorama run away, the mother tells her about the horrible difficulty of changing one's life, a description that reminded me very much of the description that C.S. Lewis does of repentance in The Voyage of the Dawn Treader, except that in C.S. Lewis's book, he is portraying God as this very kind person who lets you make this change, painful though it may be. And in Angels in America, change is a very horrible thing because God's involved in it. So that's almost word for word the same language, but these two very different perceptions of it. Now, this description of change, be it ever so painful, motivates Harper to change her life. But again, is this coming from within her, or is it coming from an external source? Hard to tell. However, it's really the credit card that worries me. Harper had to leave Joe. As soon as she says to him, what do you see? Look at me, what do you see? And he says, nothing. She has to go. There's nothing left in that marriage. But I'd have been a lot happier if she'd cleaned out the savings account or negotiated for financial support for a finite amount of time. Taking the credit card keeps her linked to Joe and dependent on him. She promises to tear it up if and when she gets a job. I worry that she's never going to get that job and she'll just hook up with another guy. Too many of the Mormon Harpers I've known are just waiting for the next man to lean on. The other Mormon woman, Hannah Pitt, Joe's mother, is the reason the rest of us get depressed. Hannah is one of two characters in the play with real integrity, if you define integrity as your external behavior being consistent with your internal beliefs. She's always herself, and herself is super mom. Her son calls to tell her that he's a homosexual, and she sells her house and goes to New York to rescue him, which she doesn't do, but she probably does rescue Harper. Unlike Harper's poetic speech, Hannah's is straightforward, almost terse. When the police call to tell her that they've arrested Harper for chewing down a pine tree beaver style, she responds, she what? A pine tree? Why on earth would she chew up? Well, you have no business laughing about it, so you can stop that right now. That's ugly. I don't know where that is. I just arrived from Salt Lake, and I barely found Brooklyn. I'll take a taxi cab. Well, yes, of course, right now. No, No hospital. We don't need any of that. She's not insane. She's just, and she uses this wonderful Mormon adjective, peculiar. Tell her to behave. Tell her Mother Pitt is coming. Now, what would that do? That's how many of it? Can you imagine the joy when she hears that? One of the psychiatrists who spoke on the KSL documentary talked about his own wife attending a class in which the instructor asked a group of Mormon women what they had in mind when their children grew up and went away. She asked them in a very sarcastic way, "Do you all want to become mothers-in-law?" as if that was the only future they could see for themselves. And it is the role Hannah is filling. But Kushner's Hannah changes, and at the beginning of the epilogue, Kushner pays her the ultimate compliment. She looks like a New Yorker. Now, it's real easy and slick to say that Harper's a stereotype and Hannah's an archetype. And I have to conclude, so what? And even if Kushner wasn't writing a Mormon play or writing even for a Mormon audience, I wonder if there's anything that we can take and learn from this. And I think maybe there is, and I think maybe that is that we'd better be real careful with our myth-making. It's very hard to get rid of the Cinderella myth. It's so pervasive that there's a Cinderella myth in every culture. In my bookstore, we have a shelf about this size full of Cinderella legends from Korea, China, Egypt, all over the world. It's not fair to young women to teach them that all they need to do is grow up and marry a returned missionary and he'll take care of them for the rest of their lives. And it is not fair to young men to teach them that if they just rescue this waif, they're okay. That's all life is. We're sort of engaged in a remaking of myths right now. We're rewriting Mormon history. We're saying, look, there were women there too. We're saying, look, there are women here now. And I think we better be careful about that. Mormon women need role models, but they don't need role models that are larger than life. They need real women. And I think we need to be real careful that we build neither archetypes nor stereotypes, but individuals for role models. Thank you.
I wish I'd known I was going to be doing this when I saw the play. I'm a quintessential dyslexic. My life is in total disarray, and it's no different today than any other day, and it's certainly my capacity to deliver like these two folks is not there. However, I do have very, very strong impressions of the play, and it's the way it approaches a characterization of my own life to a very large extent. In fact, it was rather shocking for me in that respect. And it's interesting, this whole angel thing is fascinating to me, the way it's come about. And I must emphasize that when I was a boy, my grandfather had two books that I pored over. They were sort of compendia of literature and art and things like that. And there was a Victorian painting of who's the bloke who put wax wings on and crash-landed with his dad. Right. Icarus with the maidens weeping over his corpse. And that painting mesmerized me. And when I came upon the Mormon church and was shattered to find they did not believe angels had wings, I almost quit right then. I really was very distressed about that, and I argued at length about it. I also argued at length about Christmas Day, and so you can see how trivial some things can be for me. But it's interesting that about 3 years ago, I was sitting with a friend who's here today, coincidentally, in a beautiful, I think, Episcopalian church in Los Angeles, doodling in my sketchbook while listening to another Mormon friend who was playing the doing an organ recital. And I drew in my sketchbook this figure that was a man just looking down like this with his hands like this with two spikes rising from his hands, and then I added wings to him. Long before I had any sense of the angel craze. And then the last thing I added to that drawing was an erection. Now, I am by nature not controversial. The last thing on earth I ever want to be is shocking or controversial, so I don't do erections in my paintings casually. However, this painting is now, in fact, I have a photograph of it in progress, It's in my studio. It's a great big thing, and who knows what its future will be. And I'll pass it around so you can see it. But I want you to know that when I saw this play, I saw this painting. In many respects, I wish I had as lucid a view of the play as we have just heard from two different points of view. Perhaps because I've long since been out of the church in its tight, constrained view, I didn't really see the play as Mormon bashing at all. I saw it as though I did see some very unkind characterization, but I thought that was true for an enormous number of the characters. There was a kind of brutality to the whole thing, and honesty, we would call it in modern lingo, that, by the way, I also don't fit as that kind of honesty, because I come from a culture where it's sort of about 1930s, remote Africa. Of course, I don't go back that far, but that's the kind of culture I come from, where you don't rock the boat, and you certainly don't say nasty things to each other or about each other. You certainly don't use the language that we had in Angels in America. Needless to say, in the last 10 years of my life, I've heard lots like that, and my children are just as casual as can be about these things. In that respect, the play and life has passed me by. But at the same time, the play was a riveting, potent, and powerful experience for me. of the fact that, and ironically, one of the characters that I most identified with in the play was poor Joe, earlier referred to as a schmuck, and to a large extent he was, but that was me for part of my life. I was Joe, torn apart between my love of this great visionary institution and those wonderful students at BYU that I taught, and this vision that I created for myself and for my wife and children in Alpine, Utah, where we built a kind of paradise. And out on those etchings that I got out here, you'll see our cow. We had this cow that was part of this vision, which is a pain in the neck for mucking out the barn, let me tell you. But nonetheless, you know, you could get by over some of that, and Elaine and I would sort of work hard at this. So the toughness of that play, which is a characteristic of our time and art generally, was hard for me. And the toughness of life is hard for me in that respect. So this painting is very daring for me. But Joe was me for a short period of my life. And in many respects, that was one of the areas that I found to be most potent and most painful. The sense of caricature, I think, happened throughout the play for me, and I guess that's the nature of theater. Theater's forced into those kinds of that kind of diminishing of time and so on and so forth. However, what's happened for me with the play is every one of those characters, if I ever think about them, they carry on now. So the limitations of time and theater weren't there for me, and in that respect, I see it as a very, very successful entity, because those individuals live with me now, and they continue to live beyond the limitations of the play. And so for me, Joe grows from his schmuck stage and through this agonizing confusion and weakness, ultimately perhaps to a kind of strength as he finds himself. Belize was an enormously endearing caricature for me, but he's a caricature, and I've known people like that. I've known people like that still, and in each of these characters, I have very close personal friends who were in the place of Pryor and dying of AIDS, and with, in a sense, the same heroism and anger. Gerald Pearson, whom many of you might have heard, is a case in point. I knew Gerald very, very well, and I know his wife, Carolyn, very, very well. And so a lot of it was there for me in that respect. And the play, for me, read... I'm not a very critical person in that respect, and I don't know much about theater, but I know that it riveted me. And sitting by my side is the first love of my life, who happens to be Russian, watching Perestroika. And it's interesting being with him and knowing how shattered he is by what has happened in his homeland, even in the 6 months he's been in this country. And so, in a sense, I saw the plays as there were the threads of hope, but it was essentially a great condemnation of failure, and the failure of vision, and the failure of humankind, and the failure of individuals. And yet, within that, there's always this little wisp of hope, and so that these characters do live on for me. And I have ultimate hope for Russia, and I have ultimate hope for America. And so I found the play, in that sense, a very compelling experience, especially having my friend sitting next to me, who happens to speak very, very good English. He absolutely, the play grabbed him too, rather surprisingly. He, interestingly enough, is a young man, but he despises the gay caricature, and he despises the gay subculture and the gay ghetto. All of those things he finds difficult to relate to, because he just sees himself as a person, and he feels he's been treated as a person in his life, and what gay life he knew in Russia, he was just a person, and he loves the spectrum of humankind. And that's what I felt that the play portrayed for me. It portrayed a vast spectrum. Unfortunately, people did need to be characterized with force and with specifics, and in that respect, I resented Joe being as weak as he seemed to be. My heart bled for Lewis and his terror of this disease. Not that he was afraid to get it, perhaps, but that he was terrified of having to watch his friend die. His cowardice is nonetheless cowardice. But still, I felt that I found myself identifying with each one of these characters because they were me, male and female. Queenie Gay and Joe, they were all part of my own experience, and very painful experience it has been. And so for me, I have to call the play a great success. And if I can summarize by saying one thing, why I call it the greatest success as I do is in my own discipline, the visual arts. I've seen over the last 50 years, at least as I've studied the history of art, the visual arts being more and more reduced to what I call aesthetic masturbation. This play was not aesthetic masturbation. This play took issues and tangled with them and fought them and wrestled with them and developed and pulled and pushed. Certainly there were clichés. At one fragment, when I first heard a reading of the play, I thought this was written by a Mormon. Then, of course, I quickly realized it wasn't written by a Mormon. But that simplistic view is part of the dilemma that perhaps any artist will have to deal with. But the bottom line is, I came out of that play feeling this guy is dealing with issues. He is not just toying with our senses. He is forcing us to face some realities in a vast array of them, and encyclopedic. Enormously courageous in that respect, I thought. And so I came out of it changed. And as I say, these characters live on for me. And finally, I just have to make another reference to the angel, and I agree with those characterizations that have been made earlier. And for me, just as I was destroyed by angels not having wings in Mormonism, I was equally destroyed by the sensuality of this angel being pushed to the point of being total caricature. The angel that I painted, in my view, is no caricature, and he represents the human dilemma as we're torn by our sensuality and our spirituality and the need to marry those parts of ourselves. And this is what my painting is all about. And I feel that the play indirectly dealt with that, but came out not really conclusively, and if anything, and perhaps there are no conclusions. If there's anything I've learned in life, perhaps that is it. But my final feeling is that I was really glad to be there. And it read as my life, and it read as my own art, and it verified what I'm doing with my work. And as a matter of interest further, made me realize how often I have doodled in my work. I've trivialized my work by not being as aggressive and following my core, largely because of financial responsibilities and family responsibilities. But still, the play made me want to be the artist I believe I can be. And so in that respect, I couldn't help but call it very successful. Thanks.
We have about 15 minutes left to handle comments or questions. Would you direct them? Maybe the other two panelists should be up here so we can respond. Okay, is there any comments here? Yeah, maybe nobody has a comment. Yes.
What is the background of the author Kushner? What's his religion?
Kushner is Jewish. He was brought up in all places in Mississippi, New Orleans. You sure? Okay. In the South. And does that say enough? A lot of good playwrights. Yeah. But he does show in his play a lot of respect for Jewish tradition, and he uses Jewish metaphor quite a bit. His parents, his father was in a symphony orchestra, which they moved to the South for some symphonic reason, which I can't recall. And he had written a couple of plays before this one, which haven't received any particular acclaim to this point.
Dee, maybe you know more about his background.
Yeah. Okay. For the tape, the comments have been about the Jewishness of Kushner and living in the South. My aside here is the only other Southern Jewish person I know is Jessica Tandy. Yes.
This is a comment, I guess. I don't know if there's any question wrapped up in it. But I find that Mormons who take offense at Angels in America, it often out of the same mouth, you will hear complaints that it is about us and that it isn't about us.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
Why did it have to be about Mormons? And then in the same voice, it's like, well, but they didn't give us enough credit for what we're all about and what we really like.
There's only one part of the play that offended me as a Mormon, and that was dealing with Joe's garments. And I felt that the only people who would know what that was about were Mormons, and that if you're not a Mormon, that probably doesn't offend you because you don't have any idea what's going on. And it could only have been put in to offend me, and it succeeded.
Well, I was just going to say that I see Mormonism as more as a device in the play than
yes.
as a central theme.
Right, absolutely.
And it plays well, and one thing can illustrate that. When we were having an affirmation conference at the Santa Cruz Boardwalk, we had the marquee up there said Affirmation Gay and Lesbian Mormons. And our then executive director, Irwin Phelps, was eavesdropping on a couple of teenage boys walking by the marquee, and one of them said to the other, "Gay Mormons? How could anyone be gay and Mormon?" And his friend turned to him and said, "How could anyone be Mormon?" But I think that sums it up. Pitting gay against Mormon, the ultimate dichotomy, the ultimate paradox, it plays a lot better than if it was gay Baptist. And I think Mormonism was a device. And the parallel with the angel was too convenient to pass up. I don't think Kushner set out to beat up Mormons because he hates Mormons. I think Mormonism set itself up, if nothing else, to be a good device against which to play the paradox.
Without having seen it in your descriptions, I assume that these characters kind of take on abstractions. I mean, they aren't very well defined, and they don't talk in consistent dialogue, or do they? I mean, I'm kind of lost in what I'm going through. It isn't like waiting for the Godot sort of thing where you just kind of numbed by not really understanding anything that's going on except you see something going on.
Well, the question has to do with Kushner's style as a playwright. Does he deal with normal dialogue, or does he use a lot of devices? Yes, he uses a lot of devices. Yes, he's capable of pages of normal dialogue, as in the opening scene of the play where a rabbi is burying Lewis Ironson's grandmother, makes quite a tribute to her. This is all very realistic and very understandable. Nothing surrealistic about that part of it. Did Kushner have Mormon lovers or other associates? I don't know.
You want to come up so you can talk to the tape?
Yeah.
If you know.
I was just mentioning that the only thing I had read was that he had a student when he taught high school in Louisiana who was Mormon and had made quite an impression on him. And I guess he was fairly close to her when he was teaching her, and that she had attended the opening night of the play, of course, hadn't seen him before.
He said he got his information about Mormonism in an interview. He said he got it from Fawn Brody and from Harold Bloom. But we both have been trying to... Of course, Bloom may have published other things before he published The American Religion. But American Religion wasn't published in time for him to have gotten it from that. So I don't know.
You can say one other thing that we had, that he wrote much of Millennium Approach to Hague while he was spending the summer at Sundance Institute.
Ah.
Working on it. And was in
Utah. Ah.
Okay. You've got the. If that's true, you might have the key to it.
I didn't tell you what I studied. I had the opportunity of hearing Tony Kushner speak at length for more than 2 hours each time, on three different occasions over the period of 2.5 years, on his experience of writing. And when he spoke of why Mormons and why Mormonism, he always referred to his... There is the reference, but it was only slight, to his having had a student in high school, but the real crux of it was that he had a very, very best friend at Columbia in New York who went to school with him. And she was LDS, and they were really coming so much from the same place that they constantly amazed each other, because he was a boy raised in the South who was a homosexual, and you don't be, you're not Jewish and you're not homosexual in the South. You know, and he was very out of place. And she was raised, I can't remember, I think the Midwest, but not in Utah, as a Mormon, and discovered that she was a feminist. And you can't be a Mormon where she was raised or a feminist. And so they found this terrific common bond. Also, he said that she was his intellectual mentor, that she taught him how to write, that she taught him how to think and how to organize his thoughts. And he gives just this terrific credit to her. Also, she taught him how to desert someone who needed, not because she had a terrific, I had come out of brain surgery into ACT, first time out of the wheelchair, so I was real sensitive to this issue. She had been hit by in a terrible taxi accident and was terrifically brain damaged, and his instinct was to run, and he hated that he did. He came back. But he hated that, and there was that guilt that he brought, and also the pain of losing someone you love. And there was just so much of the play that's her. He says there isn't a line in the play that doesn't come out of the pain of my love for my friend.
But that friend is Kimberly Flynn, and she's not a Mormon, so that's she's Irish Catholic. So.
Well, that's what he says, Mormon on all three occasions.
I haven't been right.
Well, on the Kim Flynn issue, regardless of what she's a Mormon or not, he had a love affair with Kim. And
she's a straight heterosexual woman. They're just good friends.
Yeah. But it was a love affair in every sense but physical. And that's how it's described. A very intense relationship with this woman who he perceives as his mentor. And she was also a Marxist, and some of the Marxist stuff that comes into the play comes from that source, apparently. Okay. That's it? Everybody tired and wants to go home? Okay. Kurt Bench asked me to tell you that he has some copies of the text of this available in the bookshop. So anyone who's interested in reading the text, visit our friendly bookseller. Thank you.
David. Well, I was just going to say, Moroni may not have been sexy to you, but... some of us, he was kind of sexy. He tells us, describes him as, having a white robe that was open, and you could see his white chest underneath that white robe. Even as a kid, I thought that was something.
And how do you react to the Urim and Thummim?